This is 4:55 on Friday, September 9th. There's something on 8080? Oh, that's Jax. Yeah, there is something running on 8080. So what was his question?
What is a tar pit or something?
Oh. Oh. Software engineering term, I guess. Okay, good. Yes. Persistent connections. That's the ticket here. Okay. This is just sort of mental warm up. I don't think there's anything. Let's see. This one's a little trickier. The IP network layer protocol. We haven't talked much about the network layer protocol, so let's see what you've inferred from what we have said. So, at least some modest level of disagreement here. So 2 is indeed the right answer. But let's think about what we've talked about in terms of having multimedia applications running. For example, we said that sort of at the level of the applications, at least, we're not interested in having reliable service or reliable stream service because the effort required to create a reliable stream service, the time it takes, the resources required, is not worthwhile for the kind of application that you have, and you actually end up with worse performance than you'd like because you're trying to be reliable, right? So that's what we wanted at the application layer. If the network layer were doing reliable streams, then we wouldn't have any sort of choice about that, of choosing the unreliable one. So best effort datagram service is the typical characterization that's used for what the IP layer, the network layer, provides in an IP network. Okay. Transport layer protocols deliver packets to what? Hosts, applications, routers. Pardon? Okay. Okay, good. So in order to get to applications, you first have to go to hosts, but remember we talked about the port numbers as a way to identify a specific application, and they're associated with the transport layer protocols. If you just want to get to a particular host, you only need the what layer? The network layer. Yeah, the job of the network layer is to get the packets to the host, and the transport layer contains the additional information that's needed to identify a particular application. One more. TCP is reliable datagrams, best effort datagrams, reliable streams, best effort streams. Best effort datagram service, that's for sure. Not even sure what that would be. Sorry, a best effort datagram service. I do know what that would be. No, it's not a reliable datagram service, guys. The datagram service in IP is UDP, and it's a best effort datagram service. Somebody answered that. TCP is a stream protocol, right? That's how you make it reliable, is you know that you're going to be getting things that come in order, and you're going to want to get all of them, so that's sort of the idea of being a stream, and to make it reliable, you just check to make sure that you've got everything that you expected to get before the thing that you got now.
So it can be, because I was thinking it was going to be, well, I was thinking reliable datagram, but I was also thinking it'd be streaming, because you can have a persistent connection and it just constantly uses the same thing, which would be streaming. But I guess in the case of a non-reliable or a non-persistent connection, I guess it's still streaming, but it acts in a like datagram sort of way.
Okay. So I think what you're reacting to is sort of a higher level notion, right? With a say a HTTP request, you're getting the response to a particular URL. Say, yes, you get that as a chunk, but it's delivered as a stream because the whole thing won't fit in one packet. So at the packet level, what you've got is a bunch of packets that make up a stream. Okay, which is the unit that you were thinking about. Okay, but at the networking layer, it's a stream. Okay, and so the streaming, reliable stream services are what you use when you want to be sure that you transfer the data and get all of it in order.
Because it still sends it as an entire object, so that would be
Yeah, but it comes as a bunch of packets, and so it's
streaming. It's streaming.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Good. All right. See, when we ask questions, when I ask questions and you respond, then we find out about misunderstandings. So that's good. Okay. That's enough of that. Yeah. So today we are going to finish talking about electronic mail and talk about DNS, the domain name service, and what its role is in the network. And then next time we will talk about socket programming and the assignment. So the assignment is posted. Please take a look at it. Well, I hope it's posted. If somebody can check and make sure, that would be good. I'm not sure that I turned the crank to do the last step.
It's not a link yet.
It's not a link yet. Well, let me fix that. I can do that. It should be now. Yes? No? No? Okay, well, I'll have to fix it after class. It will be fixed after class. So please read it, is the point. Read the assignment, see what you're up against, so that you sort of know what you're focusing on in the lecture on Monday that talks about socket programming. Meanwhile, today we want to finish talking about mail. So, start this thing. So last time we talked about the mail servers, how that they had queues of mail that they were exchanging with other SMTP servers, the mail servers, and that somehow or other they also had mailboxes for users into which the mail was delivered by the mail servers. And that doesn't tell us then how the user agents are going to interact with the mail servers in order to get the mail out of the mail server. The one thing to see here is that this is a client server. This is a distributed system. This is a system of peers, the SMTP servers. But they act in a client-server sort of way. A sending mail server looks up the address of the receiving mail server using DNS, which we'll talk about, and makes a connection to it, and so behaves like a client with respect to the receiving mail server that acts like a server. Okay. So the protocol is a simple mail transfer protocol, SMTP. It classically works over port 25. So this is an example of one of these applications that is so common in the internet, it has been assigned a sort of fixed address of port 25 on all servers. And the sending server makes a connection to the receiving server using the same sort of mechanism that a web client makes to a web server. It exchanges a bit of text about sort of like the headers in the HTTP, transfers potentially many messages, and then closes the connection. The interesting thing here is that the commands, the responses, and the messages are all done using 7-bit ASCII characters. So all the internationalization of mail, all the ability to do attachments with videos and things like that, which are clearly not 7-bit ASCII, happens because all of those things can be encoded into 7-bit ASCII. You know, you take something that is a stream of bytes, 0 to 255 in every byte, and according to another set of standards, you convert it into a big block of text. And if you look, if you use a system like Firefox or Thunderbird that uses a real sort of mailbox file system, you can actually open up the files with a pure text editor and see the contents that what these contents look like in pure ASCII. They don't make much sense, right? But the mail user agents know how to interpret them back into what they started out as. So, gee, it doesn't work in any sort of unsurprising sort of way. You use a user agent to compose the mail. You send the mail to your own mail server, addressing it to Bob. And the mail server then talks to another mail server and sends that on. There could be many hops along the way here, actually. You don't have to do it in just two hops. But it's common that it is. No, it's common that it isn't, now that I think about it. Because, for example, for the WSU mail server and the EECS mail servers, there are multiple hops in here associated with doing spam checking on the mail. So, in fact, we ask that our mail be sent to a company that checks it for spam first and then sends it on to us. And all those interactions happen with SMTP. If you... Well, I don't have... I can do this. I'll open up a message and show you what it looks like. Pick a modestly and moderately interesting one. So, in Thunderbird, if that happens to me, your mailbox, mail agent, you can use Control U to see the source of the message, and can I do Control Plus to make it bigger? I can. Is that visible at the back now? You see what that says. So it's a traceback. It's like a program stack almost that you see. The history of one of these mail messages. My mail server where I get mail is zmail1.eecs, but it mail for EECS has been told to go through pphosted for virus scanning, and it received it from ACML. And ACML received it from Lychee message from a listserv. And okay, so anyway, you can see that it actually has gone through many hops of SMTP, each of these received by things. It looks like ACM has some process in place that they're going to send out mail. They want somebody to approve it before that it actually goes out. So that happens. And you can see the history of the thing. Let's scroll down. Maybe there's some of the encoding in it. Yes. Cool. Hmm. Okay, so there's these received headers. Notice how much they look like the HTTP headers, right? They're sort of a different kind of information, but they're formatted in the same way. There's a then the sort of classical from to, who sent it. There's precedence. There's some other headers that may or may not be understood by mail agents. And then comes the content. And the content, as you see, is all ASCII, even though what's in this mail is more complicated than that. I don't know. One of the problems with fast computers and networks is that it just becomes really easy to send lots of garbage around and do things that sort of in a more impoverished world of bandwidth would be silly, like anyway, because it looks like there are multiple copies of the contents here to cope with the foibles of different mail agents, for example.
There was an interesting article last year about the carbon footprint of spam because of the power and
right.
Time that
yeah.
The resources that it takes to deal with
them. Yeah. Kind of interesting. Okay, where are we here? Okay. So it's not simply from one mail server from source to destination, but lots of hops in between. So here's what an interaction looks like. When you make the connection to the server, it's actually the server that talks first in this scheme. And it identifies itself, and the client issues a hello message. Not hello, but it means hello. But they only wanted four characters because it was invented in a time of impoverished bandwidth, and gives its own identification. And then you give commands saying who you're sending the mail from, and then who the recipients are on that mail server, and then data, and the data command, and then you type type the content of the message, and finish it off with a line that just contains a period. So, of course, notice here's where protocol definition really matters. What if you want to have a line with just a period in your message? It signifies the end of the message. So this is one of the sort of things that a mail agent has to worry about is how to essentially escape a line with only a period in it so that it will be seen on the other end as belonging to the message as opposed to being the end of the message. So that gets taken care of according to the rules of the protocol. And then it says okay, and then you can actually send another message if you want by saying data again, by going back to the mail from and recipient to scheme. Yeah.
So it's actually looking for like a carriage return and then a period, right? Okay. That's the end.
And then another carriage return.
And then another carriage return.
Yeah. Or a carriage return line feed, actually, I think. But you see, it's all ASCII. And you can telnet to port 25 on a mail server and have one of these conversations. Now, these days, use of SMTP on port 25 using plain ASCII exchange is discouraged for security reasons. All of this mail is sort of visible to anybody who can see those packets, and you may not want that. So these days, SMTP is typically tunneled in in some sort of secure protocol like SSL or TLS or one of those ways of doing things. So many mail servers that in the past would have accepted connections on port 25 no longer will. they'll say go away if you try to connect to them. The other thing that the more secure versions of the protocol do is that they insist that the person sending the message identify themselves in a at least somewhat secure way, so that not just anybody can use a mail server to send traffic, because that promotes spam. Mail servers that will let anybody connect to them and send to anybody go by the name of open relays, and system administrators who run open relays don't have high reputations in the field, because they enable their spam enablers. Okay, so uses TCP. It uses ASCII, and like HTTP in some respects, but the thing it's doing is a little different. What goes into mail is a header, and we saw the headers, you know, the received froms and the froms and the tos and the dates and so forth. It turns out that one of the most difficult things about mail over the years has been getting dates right, standardizing the thing that you say in a date field. It's surprisingly complicated and hard to get right. Yeah, it could be. That's sort of how it ends up being done in some sense, because the thing that you write for the date is your current time and your time zone expressed as offset from GMT. You could just as well put GMT in there all the time and leave it up to the user agents to translate that to local time if that's what the recipients desired. But dates and times are problematic around the world.
What's the purpose of the 7-bit ASCII rather than just using a regular 8-bit?
It's historical. It was a protocol that would run over serial links. You could run SMTP over serial links that could only carry 7-bit ASCII. These days, of course, everything is done over top of IP, so 8-bit bytes are the norm for everything else.
So, I mean, the way that the data is actually stored, it's always in, you know...
It's always stored in 8 bits, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, are they just wasting a bit every time, or is it packed?
Well, when it's going over the wire, you only need to send 7 bits per character.
So that's the frame size.
That's the character size of a what was it called? Well, when you make a serial connection over a modem, typically at this time anyway, it was 7 bits per character that was sent. And if you wanted to send 8, you have to sort of do some sort of encoding trick to expand the size of the message in characters.
So as it's stored on either side.
But stored on either side, you're wasting a bit.
Okay.
You bet. Okay. So how do people talk to these things? Using user agents. You saw Thunderbird. You probably each have one of your own that you like. Doesn't matter. Those user agents have to talk to the mail servers, and interestingly, they use SMTP to send messages. So when you've done this, right? You've configured your mail agents, and the sending server is a separate thing from the receiving server, and that's because for sending, even the mail agents use SMTP, whereas for receiving, they use typically one of these other protocols, POP or IMAP, to access the mailbox, right? When you're sending something into the into the mail service queue. When you're receiving, you're getting it out of your own mailbox. And so post office protocol is the old-fashioned way of doing it. It's still widely used. And IMAP is a newer way. Let's see, I think I have a slide. Yeah. So POP3 is again a pure ASCII protocol that you could type in list messages, get messages, delete messages. The idea with POP3 is that you in the user agent actually retrieve the mail from the mailbox, take it out of it, and become responsible for storing it on the user agent machine itself. IMAP is more intended for the situation where you're going to have lots of space available on your mail server and just leave the mail there and interact with it in place. You can make copies, you can make cached copies and so forth, but the mail really is intended to stay in place. When you delete something, it goes away from the mail server. And that's how I live with multiple machines, and maybe you do too. If you're using a classical user agent, using IMAP, you can just point all your machines at the same mailbox and have a consistent view of the mail everywhere. Using POP3, it's trickier.
Right. So if you're using, like, say at work, everybody's using Microsoft Exchange.
Uh huh.
Is that which type?
Microsoft Exchange can do all of these, right?
So it's
the network admin's decision and the user's decision. So if you interact with Exchange using Thunderbird or something like that, you'll use one of these two ways of doing it. If you're interacting with it using Outlook, then it's actually a proprietary protocol that's more like HTTP, somewhat like IMAP as well, but many more sort of features that you can do, like Exchange can, when you get email that is sent as a request for an appointment, it can add it to your calendar automatically, and stuff like that. And you can retract emails, right? So, yeah, fun stuff. POP3. Okay, so IMAP is good if you have lots of machines that all need to interact with the same mail. Gmail, Hotmail, those guys pull the same sorts of tricks using HTTP. But what you don't get with Gmail and Hotmail and those is sort of easy ways to have a local view of the mail that will work when you're offline, which IMAP does provide. Okay, we got to talk about DNS, and we're going to have to talk about DNS some next time too, because there isn't enough time here. Okay, so DNS, Domain Naming System, or Name System. The idea is that we've talked about how to get packets from one place to another in the Internet, we put IP addresses in the packets, and those are numbers, right? They're just a four-byte sequence of bits that make up the IP address of a host. And so it turns out to be just a big number. And you can carve it up into easier to understand ways of talking about numbers, but it's still just numbers. And that isn't very convenient when what you want to do is talk to Google or Yahoo or your bank or something, where you'd really like to use the name of the entity that you're talking to. And so DNS was created specifically for the purpose of mapping between DNS between names and IP addresses. And the question that then arises, and it's actually sort of amazing that DNS has survived from roughly 1980 when it was created until 2011, which is now. It was created for an internet in 1980. What did we say? It had something like 100 hosts in it. And now we're up to billions. And the key insight that occurred that made all this work was that we could build a hierarchy of names. We could build a system in which one organization had responsibility for one piece of the namespace and a different organization had responsibility for a different space. And we did that recursively so we could sort of make it happen at arbitrarily large scale, right? Because remember, it's like a n-ary tree. It grows exponentially with the number of levels. So it doesn't take very many levels to express anything at all, to name anything at all, as long as the fan-out factor is large, and it is, right? It's already sort of in the 100 or so at the very top level, and we'll talk about levels, but you can sort of fan out arbitrarily much at each level, and so it doesn't take too many names and too many levels to name anything. But then you have the problem of how do you organize the services to map those names into IP addresses, which is what we've got to do with the DNS. So it's distributed using name servers. There's a protocol for the hosts in the internet to talk to those name servers and get them to do the process called resolving names, which is translating the names from names to IP addresses. The other thing that's interesting about DNS is that this is one of those glue protocols that makes the internet work. It seems like it ought to be a core service of the network, but in fact it's implemented sort of at the edge. So that's an interesting perspective on what's going on here. It's like this is central to the operation of the internet, but it isn't a network layer protocol, it's a application level protocol. So you're able to sort of move back and forth through these layers to do different things.
So,
yeah.
Does that mean that depending on your location, you can type in the same URL and then you might get directed to a mirror somewhere?
Uh-huh.
And since that's an edge level thing, then you'd actually have just a different IP address that would come up when you type the same URL depending on your location.
Right.
That's how that's done.
Well, it is. And that's a good thing and a bad thing, right? Because it raises the whole question of when in Iran you type in gmail.google.com, you get directed to a server run by the government of that country that intercepts your mail and lets them read what you're sending. Okay, there are some other mechanisms called secure HTTP and certificates and certificate authorities that are supposed to keep that from happening. But when that breaks down, then the other thing breaks down too. Then it can be combined with a break of the other kind, and you've just given somebody the ability to read your mail. Okay, so it's not supposed to happen in general, except for these redirection things. But okay. So the basic functionality is host name to IP address translation. But there are also some other things that it does that naturally layer onto it as additional features. You can give aliases. You can define aliases for hosts within the DNS system. So, for example, if you go to www.clicks.org, right, that's defined to be an alias for clicks.eecs.wsu.edu. You can just plug in things like that. Mail servers, you know, typically one mail server doesn't have an IP address of the other mail server as part of a mail message. It just has the name of the DNS name of the organization. And so one thing that DNS provides is that given the name of an organization, it will tell you what the mail server name is for that organization. So you send to Hauser at eecs.wsu.edu, it looks up eecs.wsu.edu and says, what's the mail server for that? And it says, well, it actually says the company that does the spam filtering. You can give different addresses for one name, in case you want some traffic for that name to go one place and some another way. Not very well defined what that behavior should be, so there are probably better ways to that. It's distributed, right? It is implemented by hundreds of thousands of different organizations around the globe to make this work. Some of them have control over very high levels of the hierarchy, and others have control over very local parts. You can run your own DNS for your own network if you want. That's possible to do. So why does it have to be that way? Because nothing else works, right? There's nothing on this planet that sort of attempts to provide service from a centralized location for the entire population. It just doesn't work. And so it has to be broken up, and that's what the DNS does. The fact that it was designed that way from the start is kind of surprising, given that at the time that they were designing it, they only had 100-ish sort of hosts to worry about. So let me write down. I use Clicks because it's easier to write out than the name of my office machine or my or my laptop. It's short. So that's a typical DNS name. It has. It's actually the case that really, there's another dot there, but we often don't have to write it. That dot corresponds to the root of the DNS hierarchy. And you sort of go backwards through the name. At the root, there are databases that tell us about what's happening in the EDU domain. In the EDU domain, we have databases that tell us what's happening there. And within those databases, you'll find an entry for WSU. And you get to the WSU servers, and it knows about EECS. And you get to the EECS servers, and they know about the machines and the mail for EECS. So when you want to, when your machine is trying to go to this address, find out the address of this machine, it actually has to go through to first approximation doing a lookup at all those locations. Now, it turns out that with caching in various places, you can often short circuit some of those lookups and end up not having to do all of those for every update, which is a good thing, because think about, again, if you have the root is a centralized service, and it may be distributed across a few machines, but it can't be distributed across too many. So it's a very good thing that every time somebody does a visit to a website, they don't have to make a query of the root domain servers. Okay, root servers 13. All right. Spread around. So at the top level, we have things like com, org, net, edu, nowadays, biz, name, XXX for porn sites. There's a whole bunch of other ones that were just added.
That just went through the XXX.
Yeah. Was one of them. And in addition to all those sort of that have semantic content about the sort of organizations to which they belong, there are also two-letter country codes for all the countries of the world that have been assigned. And so you can also get .us names, and there's a country whose country code is TV, and they make a lot of money selling their domain names to TV shows. but it really doesn't have anything to do with television. It's really a country code. Okay. Different organizations then run the name servers that are responsible for the individual top-level domains. And so I mentioned this idea of caching. Caching, again, is important because if you don't cache, then you beat too hard on the people who have the answers. So part of the configuration of DNS is to say which machines are authoritative, those that are known to have the correct answer that you can believe for any sort of subdomain. Other servers can keep caches of that information, but they're known as not authoritative, and when they need an answer, they will go to the authoritative server. So DNS really most important thing is DNS records who is authoritative for each domain. It can be multiple servers. The process by which they are kept consistent is not part of DNS. Yeah, so you can ask the authoritative server about something. Local name servers are typically configured as default name servers. They don't have to be authoritative for anything, but they provide the service to the clients of looking up names. So on a Windows machine, if you have a Windows machine open, you can type into a command shell ipconfig/all, and it will tell you, amongst a whole lot of other things, what name servers are configured for you to use. And that will typically be a local name server. On a Linuxy machine, it's typically stored in this file etcresolve.conf. It says the name servers are like so. Those happen to be name servers on an EECS network. It also says that the domain is eecs.wsu.edu, which is what the machine here is supposed to look for if I give it a name that isn't a fully qualified domain name. So if I just say clicks on this machine, I think I have a host command. It actually expands it by appending eecs.wsu to the end, and then does a lookup on that, and you see that it actually comes back and says that it's a alias for something else, and then we look up that address and we finally get to the IP address. So there are multiple lookups that may have to be done in order to get from the name you start with to the IP address that you can really use. Well, we're out of time. So we will finish this next time, and then we'll talk about socket programming and the assignment. Have a great